Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to MLR Chat. This is our third and last program from live from Weekend with the Masters out here in San Diego. And okay, it looks like Blog Talk Radio wanted to tell me we were on the air a couple times here, but sorry for that interruption. But I wanted to bring in also, because we have one of my co-hosts on the air with us today. Hello, Blanche. How are you?
I'm doing great, Linda. I know you've had a good day out there.
Yeah, it was fun. I actually walked around and saw a couple different people, Carolyn Anderson, C.W. Mundy, George Gallo. I've popped in a couple different places. We also have with us Juliet. I'm sorry, Juliet, you say your last name for me. I'm going to always
the CDs. It's a hard one.
CDs. It is. You know, I walked around, like I said, when we did the first show with you, and I walked around and kept practicing it, and now I think I have it in my mind wrong, so that's why, you know.
Thanks.
Bless your heart.
I'm finished.
Yeah. But I actually didn't get a chance to get in and see any of your workshops, but we're going to have you talk a little bit about your experiences here and how much you love it here in a few seconds. And I know Blanche may have a few questions for you as well. I also want to talk a little bit about some of the other guests who will be dropping by here in a little bit. Michael Harding will be dropping up again. I'm going to actually start calling this the Michael Harding Show. And then and then also, he promised me that he was going to strong arm and take by the hand Rosemary Thompson of Rosemary Brushes to come up and talk to us as well about her brushes. And I asked George Gallo to stop by again because George did a demo today with all new materials. He did Ramar 4, which he's never painted on before, Rosemary's brushes, which he's never used before, and then Michael Harding's paint. So I wanted to make sure that you know, he came up and talked to us about the experience of doing that in front of a live audience. Not a lot of folks could probably change all of their materials right before Julie's shaking her head.
Yeah, that's brave.
Yeah. So, I don't, Blanche, I know from last night you really didn't get a chance to ask very many questions, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but do you have a question for Juliet?
Oh, I was just looking here at what she's been doing over the last couple of days. I think, Juliet, yesterday you did a drawing workshop.
No, yesterday was painting workshop. It was
painting.
It was a limited palette, and the day before was a sepia pencil. But don't worry, Bunch, it all blurs together for me also.
Oh, I've got it confused. So you did
yeah,
painting.
Yeah, a half-day today, right?
Yeah, half-day drawing demo and lecture.
Yeah, so they keep you busy.
Yeah, very busy.
Well, that's amazing. It's amazing for all these people to get to come and be around all these wonderful artists, all in one place. That's a wonderful place to be.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to ask Juliet was, this is her first year at Weekend with the Masters, and what I wanted to do was just kind of ask her for her insights and experiences. Did you enjoy it? How were your students? Were they, I'm sure they were very talented and very willing to learn and listening, but give us your insights and how great you think the weekend was.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing just to drop in and a totally different studio, all new people, and have a lot to learn in just a few short hours. And I was very impressed with even a fair amount of beginners showed up, and everyone seemed more than willing just to dive in, very receptive, and asked a lot of questions, and the energy was very high. So altogether, it's been such a creative experience. And one of the things I didn't anticipate, or I failed to fully anticipate, was how much energy just happens outside of the classroom as well. By the second day, you know so many people, so it sort of feels like a small town where you know everybody
right.
After a few days. So the intensity of this experience has been wonderful.
Yeah, and since everybody's staying at the hotel, it seems that that it's being hosted at. It really definitely feels like it's just this little artist community or commune or something. You'll go out to dinner and you'll run into all the artists who are sitting around eating dinner and, mm-hmm. and having great time with sponsors. And, it's just been a wonderful time as far as that's concerned. And the other thing that has amazed me, because I've walked into a number of workshops, is the level of the students or the participants here, the talent level, to me has been amazing. I was telling my husband and Blanche before we came on the air, I'm not so sure I'd come here today. Some of these people were somewhat intimidating to me.
It's intimidating.
So I had everyone who just began, had just anyone new to cleaning raise their hand, and a full third of people at least in my cleaning class just raised their hand.
Oh, great. So I just went to the wrong workshop.
You weren't saying wrong workshop.
Great. Well, I wanted to also talk about, or actually welcome to the show, Michael Harding has just joined us, and also Rosemary Thompson from Rosemary's Brushes.
Hi, everybody. Nice to be here again.
Hi.
Hey, Michael.
How you doing?
How are you doing?
Yeah, everything's good. Thanks.
I was kidding around before you came in. I said, I think we're going to start calling this the Michael Harding Show.
Oh.
He's our most loyal guest.
I like it now. No, my modesty has been forgotten. Great idea.
No, we're very happy that you spent the time with us, because I think you've added so much to it.
It's been just great fun. It's just nice to know that there's people outside. It's great. And as Linda was saying, this is the whole feel of the thing. I mean, I wish I liked this all the time. But it's just, to us guys, we don't think of it as work. It's like being on a working holiday. And the atmosphere is brilliant. I know we've tried to describe it each day. But, I mean, yeah, it's hard to have a bad time in sunny California. But, really, it's just been such fun.
Have you two know each other?
Nope, we've seen each other around, but this is the first time we've actually met. How do you do?
And that's the other great thing about the live radio show, and I don't know if you know Rosemary or not, but Rosemary did say well. But it's that there's been a lot of introductions that have happened over this table while we've been doing the art show and the radio show, and it's been absolutely great to see everybody network and get to know one another and talk to one another with that. So stop by and try to paint tomorrow, Juliet.
Oh, yeah.
I've always been too busy. Every time I've walked by, I've wanted to come and ask questions about that incredible Grisaille rental. But we get over there.
The interesting thing about that, it's not a Grisaille. It's actually a painting which is faded.
Oh. I know, it's
The Dutch, for those of you out there in Listen Land, it's the Countess or Duchess of Albemarle by Joshua Reynolds. It hangs in our UK's National Gallery in London, and it's one of these paintings, a great example of how a colour can fade. So it's, as you realise, it's one of my big mission statements to alert everyone that they should be using sound materials, and Juliet has just discovered in a second it's not a graffiti. It's actually... It does indeed look like a charcoal drawing, doesn't it? But it's a painting with a colour faded. So, yeah, absolutely, stop by. I've got one or two other examples of great bits of technical painting which have had a bad ending, shall we say.
Juliet, just so some of the listeners may not have been aware of our previous interview with you, tell us about your atelier up in Seattle, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for the last 12 years, I've run a full-time atelier program in Seattle, Washington, a four-year program. The first year devoted to drawing, second to painting in black and white and temperature, third in color, figure painting every day, or figure light room half day, and the last year, a thesis year, and it's been a wonderful place for artists to go and learn how to train and a fun community.
And I've really, like I said, I've told you this on the previous show, I've really enjoyed looking at your paintings and your drawings out on your website. It's just wonderful. And you also have information about your atelier out on your website as well. So it'd be really great. And so now, Rosemary, we gave you a chance to settle in. So,
wait a minute.
Yeah, so I want you to say hello and maybe tell us a little bit about
your company, Rosemary's Brushes. We've heard a lot about Rosemary's Brushes because, like, as I said, C.W. Mundy was on the first night, and, uh-huh. and he loves your brushes. And George Gallo, we're going to have him come up in a little bit because he did a demo this morning with your brushes and Michael's paints and the Raymar board, which are all the materials for him. So tell us a little bit about how did you get started?
Oh, gosh, it's a lifetime ago. 31 years I've been making brushes for. And originally, I used to tie my brother's fishing flies. He's a fly fisherman.
Yeah.
As a hobby, as a pastime. And at the time, when I was at night school, turning out the paint, it was in those days that my mum said, you need to get a real job because you're not very good at art.
Oh, no.
So I went along and I studied and became a nurse in England, qualified and had my own board in gynaecology for 6 months. No connection at all with brushes.
Or the fishing flies.
No.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I continued to make my brother's fishing flies. And I was saying to Michael earlier today, I used to go and sit on the riverbank, make his fishing flies, and I'd paint. He'd be fishing, and people think, oh, that's a really lovely relationship he has with his brother, but the truth of the matter is his friend was absolutely gorgeous. And I thought, if any of you know a fisherman, the only way you're ever going to get to know him is to go and sit on the riverbank. And I used to sit there painting and complaining and moaning and grumbling the whole time because I couldn't afford decent quality materials. I just couldn't. As a student and the pay for nursing was so abysmal, but I just simply couldn't afford nice kit. And it was my brother who said to me, surely if you can make fishing flies like this, because by then I'd be making them for his friends, and, you know, I'd be earning sort of pocket money every week. So I said, right, go on, and I'll have a crack at it. And I actually started making brushes using bird's quills, which is the old way of making them. And we used to make them with bird's quills up until about 15 years ago. And so simple, you just get a bird's quill, boil it, contraction, expansion, stick some hair in the end, and you've got a brush. And I got pretty good at it. At the time, I had a German Shepherd dog, gorgeous dog.
He was a beautiful
dog, but yeah, bald dog. And that's how I learned. And also, what a lot of people don't quite realise, why would you? A lot of brush hair in those days was oxyhair hair, and it comes from the inner ear of a cow.
Oh, really?
My grandfather had a small holding with just a few cows, a few pigs, and agriculture. And we literally used to milk the cow and drink. I didn't realise milk came, you know, in bottles until many years later. We used to drink straight out the can. But Polly was my cow, and Polly ended up with bald ears.
There's been a lot of bald creatures in your life.
Because I'd go into night school, I'd be painting, and my friends would be, hey, where did you get that from? And I'd go, oh, I made it this morning, or I made it yesterday. Can you make me one? And, you know, we'll pay you for the materials, and I said, but it's all free stuff, really. I'm using it for the countryside and the hedgerows, so you don't need to pay me. And it then dawned on me one day that I could actually perhaps earn a living from doing this. So with my brother's help, I found a manufacturer of barrels, a metal bit on the end, and that's really how it started. It took off from there, and I've done the mail order now for 28 years. When I started mail order, there was no such word. No fancy title of mail order. It was, can you stick some things in an envelope and post them to me? And that's how it started. And I'm very, very fortunate. I've got a really good customer base in the UK and latterly in America. And some of my customers have stuck with me from day one.
Was it primarily in England that you had your...
Oh, absolutely.
And then when the internet came, did it start spreading to the U.S., or was it before that?
I suppose I've been supplying into the U.S. and Canada probably for 10 years, again by mail order, but I didn't start visiting the States until 5 years ago, and that's down to really, that's one guy's fault, that's why you've got me here. It's Tony Pro.
Oh, Tony Pro. We had Tony on last night. So
Tony's he is. He's like my American big brother. He's
the most gorgeous man to know.
Big being the operative word.
Yeah. he sort of persuaded me, if you like, not to be, you're not going to believe this, but I'm quite shy. And I don't want to go to America. America, people only go there on holiday. I don't want to go to work in America. And Tony's like, get over here, woman. Get yourself over here. And people love you. They love your product. And it was really down to Tony, who heckled me, is a good word. And of course, I met on the internet a guy called Morgan Weisling.
Uh-huh.
You're probably familiar with Morgan's work. He's a terrific master. And down to Morgan is a couple of the ranges that I promote in the States and can't make them fast enough. They're down to Morgan and his style, his technique. And fortunately for me, he was suffering from poor quality art materials. So Tony did the intro to us, and the rest really, Morgan just said, yeah, you'll never be able to make anything else, but go on, I'll give you a shot. I made him some brushes, sent them over, and that was it. You know, Morgan sort of bragged to everybody in the neighbourhood that he'd got these special brushes from England, made especially for him. And I was very naive. I didn't realise the importance of these people, how many people they know, how many people they influence. So that's really how I started to come over to the States, and it feels like a second home at the moment. But I love it, the enthusiasm, the artists, the people. It's just so, so different, Michael, to England.
Oh, you bet. But I mean, can I ask you a question? I mean, I know you and I have been sort of standing side by side the last couple of days, but there's a question I want to ask you, and that's, when you make a brush, I mean, I as a painter, I've tried your brushes now for a couple of years and realised that something significantly different. But maybe in your own words, you can tell us, why is it that you're... I mean, I'm not trying to get you to start trade secret things that you've developed yourself. I mean, clearly, you don't want to say it. But how do you do it? I mean, why is it that your brush is the length of the hair that you decide to cut?
Do you know, it's a combination of things. I think one of the most useful lessons in my life was being a poor artist years ago. Because I know the anatomy and physiology of a brush and the brush mark and how it's meant to form and what stroke is enabled to create. And to me, this is all so, so much common sense. If you're going to make it, you make it well.
Yeah.
Does that sound...
Totally, as good as you can get.
Yeah.
Why make it less?
And I just, I don't know, I just created something with my hands, with my fingers. I've taught the girls at work how to do the same thing. And I think probably in one sentence, and it's not a trade secret, we still handmade the things. They're
right.
Handmade. Mm. I really care about them. I mean, my daughter's here with me, Cindy, you've all met. And she's actually studying law at uni. She's not a real artist, but I drag her along to help. And she'll tell you how enthusiastic I am back at work. If a shoebox of new hair comes in from my supplier, the family don't see me for like 3 days, 3 nights. I just sit and create. And I try to. I'll look. At the value of the internet is once I get inside a museum on the internet and I start to look at paintings, and I'm like, how would they make that brush mark? What would they have had? You know? And
mm-hmm.
It's so simple for me to pull a painting to pieces and be able to think this is how they would have done it quickly. And a typical example of that is we've got a really famous artist in the UK, and he was trying to replicate Picasso. And at the time, he and I sat down and pulled the Picasso painting to pieces on this clever program on the computer, which I don't even know how to use this program. Mm-hmm. And I could straight away see how they built up the brush marks and were able to create... At the time, Mike Chapman, watercolour artist. Because back home, I'm much more known, really, for watercolour brushes. England, watercolour, together. And some of my UK customers are quite surprised when they contact me and actually realise I make oil brushes. And then it's the opposite way around here. People in the States buy the oil brushes and not so much the watercolour. But I just figured, if why move on to machines when we're making something, and this isn't cheesy at all, I actually love what I create. And people don't like that word passion. I am passionate about my work. And I can't think of, I get so emotional about it when I've made something new and I send it out to my guinea pigs. And they call
come back to me, similar to you today, Michael, when you saw Alexei. You found Alexei Steele an experience for half an hour. And Alexei just started to play with Michael's paints. I mean, I'm fortunate. I've known Alexei for a while now, and fortunately, he does use my products. But I'm not saying he's never heard of Michael, but he's certainly not played with your paint before. You could tell.
No, I mean, so often.
That must be like for you. That is how I'm trying to feel. It's so rewarding to see an artist like that. Just he got lost in your paint.
He did, and of course, people say, "Well, paint, surely." So what's going to be different there?
Some people don't get it, do they?
Same with George Gallo today. I mean, George was the first time painting today, and well, hopefully, shows up later on.
Susan Trapp.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just infectious stuff, and you know, Alexei was there, and he. For those of you who've never encountered Alexei, he's got a larger-than-life personality, to say the least. And he was just extolling, he just did unstoppable.
Mm.
And then he had to go for sleep.
Yeah, and then we've got him back late.
And Juliet, do you use Rosemary's brushes?
Oh, I have a question. This occurred to me just with one talk. Is it a little bit ironic that the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution that we sort of have this swing back hand speed? Is that intentional or is that
irony?
Yeah, I don't know. It's
I think it's both of you create handmade.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether it's coincidence that we're both in the UK or whatever it might be. Although, I mean, England, from the US point of view, is a small country where technically about the same size square miles as well. And we've got 50 million people there as opposed to 4 million that Oregon's got. So that gives you sort of a demographic idea. I come from the sort of southern end of the UK, and Rosemary's from the top, as it were. And we just do what we can, really.
Hmm.
And, it's peculiar because we both just try and approach honestly what we do. We clearly both just have a love of material. What can I say? It's just, it is what it is.
Rosemary?
Go ahead, Blanche.
Oh, I wanted to ask, Rosemary, where can someone in the United States buy your brushes? Do you buy them from your website, or are they in art supply stores?
The website, this was another thing. All those years ago, I decided I wanted to create a product and be able to sell it to the artist, the person who was going to paint with it. And I knew how, if I went through distributors, agents, wholesalers, of course they have to make a living, they have to put a margin on, and by the time it gets to the end user, the price is highly inflated, which was going back to originally why I remember sitting on that riverbank creating something, because I couldn't afford
mm-hmm.
it.
Right.
So I purposely went down the mail order track, and I've stuck with it. So in answer to your question, I'd like to think we've got a good, strong website with a shopping cart.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that's been built by my son back home. And, you can go online, you can buy. He's done it so that it's quite easy to spend money at 4 o'clock in the morning. you can click a button and it changes to US dollars or Canadian dollars for you. And, yeah, we give you several options of shipping, and some customers choose the cheaper version of shipping, and then when they're waiting 10 days, they wish they hadn't because they're painting with their fingers. Other customers choose the FedEx route so we can get them to you within 2 or 3 days normally.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, at present that's how it is, and it's to actually come into America and sell the product, and I think Michael would probably agree we're on a similar plateau here.
Yeah.
It's massive in America. I'm finding it a struggle to actually be able to produce the quantity to meet the demand. It's really a struggle.
You make these yourself. You do not have employees.
Oh, gosh, I don't make them all myself.
Okay,
no.
That's why I wanted to be known, because it sounded like you need to tell me you're sitting there 24 hours a day.
No.
You need brushes yourself.
No, back home, there's 14 of us. So although I have to say I prefer to sit day in, day out making, if I'm fortunate in any one working week, I'd probably get 10 hours at my bench making. And I usually make the specials, we call them. I still have customers.
Mm-hmm.
We have 1,600 styles of brushes. And what you can see here at Weekend with the Masters represents 10% of everything I make.
shapes.
You have 1,600 styles?
Sorry?
You have 1,600 different brushes?
Yeah, we do.
Is that what you
mean? 1,600 different brushes.
Wow.
Because I don't just supply to the art industry. We supply the electronics industry, printed circuit boards, dentistry, hospitals, the Royal Air Force. We supply car manufacturers. You'd be so surprised at how many people for a living pick up a brush and use it every day and don't create art with it. It's quite fascinating.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the brushes in my catalogue, that are my regular lines, if you like, were created for a totally different industry in the first place. And then an artist will come along to my workshop and say, what the heck is that you've made there? And they pick it up and they start to play with it and like, oh, I could use this for this, this and this. And before you know it, I've got a new, brand new range created for art, and it didn't necessarily start out like that.
Wow. Yeah, I've pulled up your website right now and I'm looking on here. An artist who paints in oils, which category would they look under?
Well, for the oil business, you've got your traditional stables. We do the mongoose, we do synthetic mongoose, and the pig whistle. But I also created a range called ivory, just because of the colour of it, really. But this is a totally synthetic range. But under a microscope, each strand's real gritty, and it just holds the pigment and lays it down on the canvas how one would want it to, with a natural bristle. So five years ago, and I created that, I was really excited because it actually does all the things bristle does, but without the nasty side. Bristle tends to splay out, difficult to clean. So I think any artist, the first time going on my website as an oil artist, I would say, yeah, if you're going to spend $20, I have $20 worth of ivory to get you into our company, to get you to know and feel our brushes, because you
yeah, that's where to start. Yeah.
That would be like your sample of practice.
I produce brushes. I think the most expensive in my catalogue is like £360 for one brush.
Wow.
The dollars is what, $600-$700?
It's way over $550.
But that's a multicolour brush. One would use that and expect it to last a lifetime, I'm thinking. But for the oil brushes, you know, for like $5, you can get something that I hope has the wow factor.
Well, that's a good price.
Yeah. I got a question for Juliet, because this is her first year teaching here, but, you know, listening to Rosemary and I've listened to Michael naturally talk about their paints with me, and you've worked with a lot of beginners in your workshops. How many times did you walk up to help them and automatically look at their materials and go, well, half the struggle with what they're doing is because their materials just aren't there?
Right. Well, it's the difficulty with training artists is people. One is the vision, learning how to see and train your eye. And ultimately, no matter what kind of artist you are, whether it's visual arts or you see with literature the same change of the sight. And then there's the element which is technical. And those two need to work together. So you can develop, when you're just getting started, there's a tendency to think that as soon as I can learn to see and understand how an image is made, I'll be able to, off and running. And then only to find the papers I'm holding up, or you're using poor paint, or you're using a poor brush, and find a handicap with being able to run with it. And so we do find that people need to use poor materials, and you're not exaggerating. If they're able to invest a little bit of time and energy in that, charcoal that doesn't crumble, or a brush that's able to make a fine mark versus a gigantic one, all those things make a difficult task a little easier.
And how does the student, it's kind of a question of how do I know when my materials aren't performing the way they should? I'm a beginner, right? I don't, unless you come and show me, hey, look at the difference between this brush and look at the difference between these paints. There's this whole, there's a conversation of I'm going to continue to struggle because I think it's my lack of skill versus...
Well, at times it is. I mean, it's a combination. There's
paintings are very, you know, called a language with a long history, and it requires some study, but it's difficult. You know, if you, for example, let me just use paper because it's easy to understand. If you're a beginning artist, you tend to be a little bit heavier with your pencil marks. It was, you know, gouge the paper, it's impossible to erase. You run into difficulties like that. So preserving the window of workability in your drawing becomes an issue, and likewise with the other materials and painting as well.
So it's always a trial and error, it's always an exploration, and never just basically have that fear to experiment, right? Just try something. Maybe at first I start blind there because I'm really tense, you know, and I don't have that confidence, but what if I try doing it, holding the pencil a different way, holding the brush a different way, try a different paint, all that kind of that, the feeling of exploration, I guess, that C.W. Mundy and George and everybody have talked about.
It almost seems like you're coming at it from one direction. I think it is the impetus for experimentation of a real love of drawing and painting. So if you love it, you find that the more time you invest into it, I mean, you could be doing it for a decade, you get more and more interested, become a lifelong student. And then when you're in that mindset, you're continually, it's not like you're continually reevaluating the materials, but you always have your antenna up for what other people are doing and how things can be improved. And nobody is able to really match what was being done. I mean, you know, it's a debate, which would be fun to have. You know, are we able to, you know, are there sculptors today that can sculpt the, you know, debatable, but there's a lot, you know, we're trying to simultaneously rebuild a lost language and at the same time, the same thing with materials. I mean, both of these things are going together.
It's fascinating because, you know, there's not always that discussion in me. Is this the material or is it me? And the constant, you know, learning that we're doing with the masters and the mentors and things like that, which I think is a great, bringing it back again with the masters, which is a great opportunity because I'm sure, you know, there were times when you were working with someone and you just said you need to get to that.
Absolutely. Sometimes I'll just buy brushes from my students, give it to them, and just, you know, the love of God, away.
I've done that. And interestingly enough, one of my students at home would not buy, she asked me what brushes I use, and I said I use Mongoose, and she is vegetarian, which is absolutely great, but she will not use any type of animal type of fiber. So I gave her all of my synthetic brushes that I don't particularly like anymore because I do like Mongoose a lot right now. So you know, I get, well, here, I'm not using any. You take these. And she came in with the worst brushes I had ever seen. And, you know, it's like after one stroke, the bristles are all hanging out in 20 different directions, and I'm like, give me these. So I know what you mean, George. Like, I just threw them away, and I just handed her the synthetic one, so at least that they would stay together. But
I think you hit the nail on the head. I can't remember the second. He said, if one make a hard task, you can harder. Well, it is, and intellectually, it's one of the best challenging things that man or woman kind can do. So it's a chance. Make the task easier if you can.
I don't know if you're probably not a Winston Churchill fan, but in his book, Painting as Pastime, well, you don't know.
Actually,
I'm quite fascinated. Okay, all right. Well, he wrote a book, Painting as a Pastime, which I'm sure you've read, and so one of the lines that jumped out at me, which I thought was so hysterical, was that when I get to heaven, I hope to devote my first million years to getting to the bottom of things, because it is such a challenging subject to work on.
Well, Churchill was an incredible intellect. I think people not only know the politics of the Second World War, but also his marvelous quotes of one liner, his sort of a gifted as Oscar Wilde, his razor sharp wit. Incidentally, I learned recently that his parrot is still alive.
Oh, really? Parrots can live for
like 140
years.
Yeah,
could I get it?
They do live forever.
Still swears.
What is it really saying, right?
he talks to swear, and it swears about Mr. Hitler to this day. Extraordinary. 60-70 years ago now. Still swearing about it. I know that's a bit of a digression, but I'm still, it's a lot of German information.
Well, Juliet on our last show had a number of great gems of quotes and things that we had used. And I think, did you close with the Churchill?
Yeah, but it was a different one.
I know people have listened. I sent you the thing. But our current listeners, if you haven't had a chance to listen to Juliet's interview, you need to go back because Juliet is just so, because of her atelier, I'm sure, in the three books, yes. She's done a lot of research, and one of the reasons why I like talking with her so much is because of how much knowledge that she can certainly help them impart. So I'm sure your students in your workshops learned an absolute a lot from you. The heads are probably still spinning because you are so knowledgeable with the subject.
So the time is so short. Yeah. Great.
Yeah. I see, Juliet, that on Sunday one of the artists is going to have a critique session.
Yeah, correct.
You have some
yeah.
people signed up for that.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful.
It's a critique session, which I expect to be just a wonderful conversation between each other there.
Uh-huh.
And definitely Watts is going to be doing that, too. And I don't know if you met Jeffrey or not.
Yeah,
okay. Because he runs an affiliate here in San Diego, so I wanted to make sure that you guys at least got together.
I've known him for a long time.
Okay.
It was a pleasure.
Great.
Well, that going to be the course?
No, because you're going to be critiquing actual participants'
I see,
students'
sorry,
work,
I
and that would be just
okay.
like...
No, I thought it was more of an open debate as well.
Yeah, no, it's a very private thing. I guess they bring in so many of their paintings,
yes,
and then they
indeed.
Walk with them or go over those ones and it's how it's being run. I don't even think there's no audience in the room from what I understand either. It's just you and the students.
Mm-hmm.
Even questions for Rosemary or Michael?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So if you're painting, at least you do your paint.
Just to reiterate, this is, although I've seen Julian wandering around at this event, it's the first time we've actually met and conversed. So I know that I've probably explained my story. And no, it's at all. I just to sort of explain to the audience out there why I'm slightly repeating. Yeah, indeed. I was an art student, couldn't get deep in paint, looked at a Rembrandt and thought, I've got to get that to a finished surface. So researched, started making my own, and hey presto, rather like Rosemary's story, sort of, that's the way you go in life. So yeah, I just developed paint fundamentally for myself initially, and then had a sort of huge following of artists beating their way to my door. And I think there's another aspect to this. I mean, Rosemary and I have both developed, if you like, I suppose you have to consider a craft skill. When you... what I was going to say, running a business is the two things to a business. It's more than just having a great product. You know, business skills are business skills and stuff. I made a few mistakes, dropped some stuff. I was sort of 20 and I knew just a little about business, but not necessarily saying I know any more now. But I got in and out of the paint making business a couple of times. I dropped back into my painting. I also spent 4 years in forestry, which I loved. I loved wild country, as I was saying yesterday. And eventually, when that work all dried up, I decided I got some commissions to do murals and got my stock of my own paint out. And of course, painting on a large scale, it doesn't take you long to get through your paint again. So then found myself making paint and deciding to sell it to a few friends, and round I go again. But this time around, this has been a very good one. I mean, I've now been making paint on a far, far better business footing since 1993 or 4, 17, 18 years, yeah. And so, we're certainly here to to stay this time. I different entity now. I've got a great team of people who work with me. I've also got a school of hard knocks, as we call it in England.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Rosemary will tell you similar stories about stops and starts and then people
uh-huh.
try and block you and...
We are little guys, aren't we?
Even if you've got a great product, it's only half the battle, and there's you learn as you go.
Can I ask you a few questions for like a second?
Of course.
Yeah. So the new brand, you know, this new color has been created the last, I don't know, how many years. So at one point, the brightest color that there was in the market was Elgin, right? I mean, that was nice in the test.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what do you think of the new color that has come since then? What's the many intrinsic values that artists who work with the switch to some of the like connection things and other people doing
most certainly. I mean, I have in my range at least 75 colors. I have very traditional things in there. I have genuine lapis lazuli, genuine vermilion, so it's sulfide. And these are all the ancient stuff that the ancients have had 200 or 300 years here more. But some of these go back before Christ. And if you think about it, their environment in those days, this is pre-industrial revolution, they had their environment to draw the materials from, like Rosemary was saying, from the wild country. You'd go out into the countryside, dig up your ochres, siennas, and grind them up in a festival mold, or you'd derive it from a dicer. So, pre-industrial revolution, these are traditional colours, which have it Rembrandt or Titian or Vermeer would be working with. In answer to the question, yes, there are some beautiful modern quinacridone dimensions, staggeringly beautiful. Numerous other things, like the peril colour and so on, these are staggeringly bright, it is beautiful. But then again, it's subjective, it's the painter's choice. What works for one artist won't work for another. I mean, Lexi, we were just playing with painters an hour or so ago, and I was showing him the stack lead that I was developing, and this is the lead white that would have been familiar to the ancient guys, and there's always this search for how did Rembrandt create his brush strokes, etc., etc. So it was a debate. And that's the sort of the palette that those guys have been playing with. But then again, Alexei was playing with a quinacridone alongside the ancient lead white, if you like. And, you know, there was a wow every 5 seconds, wasn't there?
I mean, you can mix, like, I remember hearing from someone that true vermilion, you wouldn't mix with titanium and that sort of thing.
Not necessarily so, that there's a certain amount of mystery around the vermilion. It tends to generally be under certain circumstances that sunlight will trigger it to go, they used to call it the vermilion stickness, but it has this blacky brown tendency, and no one completely is actually sure how this works. But to be honest, it's for you guys to decide, and you're the artist. If you find that your statement, your brushstroke is such that being a quinacridone or a vermilion and titanium, and that's the brush stroke the same thing you want, who are we to make rules up? It's subjective.
It's the same with the brushes, though. Somebody will walk along and pick up their idea of the Holy Grail. You know, I've got to have this. I can't create my artwork without this. And the guy next door is equally as talented an artist will say, oh, I can use this.
Yeah.
And lots of customers for the first time who see my product at the UK shows I do, we try and take as much as we can for the wow factor as much as anything, and of course we want to sell. But I want to give artists a broad selection, a choice, and they don't get that as an everyday thing. And when they come up to my stand, my booth, out there, back in England, you can see the look on their faces when they can see all these different styles. Now, another artist will come up to me and buy one number 12 and create the entire painting with one number 12. And I'm like, please don't tell everybody that you can do that. another artist will buy the brushes to create the same painting. So, very similar. Every artist is they're such a unique bunch, aren't they?
Yeah, indeed. And in answer to your question, Julie, if we don't get the rules up, it's for you guys out there. We are tool providers.
Yeah. You do the magic.
Yeah, but you do the hard bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask another question that's sort of a non sequitur, but it seems like what would you say the future of teaching is? Right now we're moving to the digital age, and you see images are different and received differently than they once were. The role of museums are changing, and people are interpreting things differently. You can go back to the 40s and hear the first discussion on what will happen to painting now that film is coming to
place.
Sure. What would you
I think
say?
It's like food, I think. It's a drug. I don't think it will ever not be there.
In a sense, I could ask you the same question back to you. If you're a painter, are you going to be doing videos digital?
Yeah.
Do you work partly digital? Or?
Mm-hmm.
No, so in a sense, it's...
But I'm a Luddite, and not everyone is. What do you think? I'll answer if you go first. You're trying a nice dodge.
I think there always is going to be traditional artists in our profession, full stop. I think qualified. I think that something like digital art, yes, perfectly valid as art. And I think that, if anything, something like digital art is clearly born out of other media. It's probably allied far more to being photography than being, say, a painter. And anyway, any art form is only as good as the artist's eye. It doesn't matter what you're working with. It is only as good as that intellect that takes place in that brain that's up on the top of that head of yours. And that is the reality. And when an artist chooses a medium, and hopefully it's a way of fluently expressing that thought train and being able to get whatever it is in your head, that mind's eye, whether you decide to be working 3D, 2D, or music, choice is yours. And no, I don't think it'll ever become extinct. Or I think we've seen some huge changes take place in certain aspects of, call it creative industry. I mean, graphic design, I mean, where's it? Wow. Like, last 15, 20 years for various reasons. Mm-hmm. When I was an art student in the 1970s, as sort of graphic designers, which would be capitalist artists of the world, and they were the ones who, you know, they knew they wanted to be a Ferrari.
Oh.
And, wow, they say, I don't know whether they converted over into those, you know, computer guru types, but yeah, that's an extraordinary thing. And I mean, I think lots of companies are probably playing around with certain types of software that can, if you like, replicate what paintings look like. But there's always got to be creativity, and that takes place in the top of one's head. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of what medium you choose to get it out.
Yeah. Well said.
Yeah,
well,
that was very well.
Well, actually, because I thought you were going to tell me off my answer.
I wanted to.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, one of the things that struck me at talking, and another side as well, is just so you're obviously with expressions and with so many artists who I've met here, and you see the images all over the place, but to take them in distance, to have the relationship, to be able to look someone in the eye, to have a conversation, not be able to just unplug the computer when you feel like you're done, like the good and the bad and the intensity of it, is something that I think we desperately miss in most of daily life. So there'll be an element, whether it's there or not, that is.
I think it's like the weekend with the master. It is so intense, it is so pleasurable that when you then go home, you get absorbed in a few days, back to reality check.
Yeah, and so like with the, you know, with the physical paint, it's like a presence.
I didn't mean to embarrass Juliet, but I was showing them some of her work to me, because I didn't want to. But I wanted to show Michael and Rosemary some of Juliet's work so that they could.
Wow.
Yeah. You guys are doing so great. Blanche, do you want to jump in? And is there a question that you...
Well, I was just, I couldn't hear y'all so well, just the last conversation, every bit of it, but I had just signed up for Rosemary's catalog online, so I'll be getting that and looking at all of her great brushes. I'm dying to get some of those.
Yeah. One of the last conversations that, well, actually the conversation that we had with Juliet on our show happened to be one of these things of the place of the artist in this century. So that was kind of like a trick question, I guess, that she was throwing on you guys. We actually put her on the spot to tell us all about that.
We'll get her back.
That was challenging because one has to think these things, but no, it wasn't, there was no evidence to me that it was a trick question. I mean, I hope that my answer was coherent. And who am I to be right or wrong? I mean, I'm just me, so who knows? But coming back to Juliet's point about Rosemary and I being human beings that exist, it's one of these things. I mean, when I was starting my company, even trying to think of a name to call it, I just...
We were talking about that.
Yeah, and I ended up using my name because I just thought it means that I endorse and stand alongside my product, and it's me.
I remember being on the motorway back home, looking at all the lorries going past, thinking, Walker's Chris, no, not good. Laura Ashley, no, not good.
Can I just say something? It's George Gallo, and I just want to say this quickly, I have to go lay down because I hurt my back. Your paint is ridiculously good. Your brushes are phenomenal. It changes the way I paint.
Oh,
wow.
I mean, really, to take your paint.
So George is there now.
Yes.
Yeah, but you have his back. Happy
out
of your back, honey.
I heard it
years
ago when I worked
with Travis
Coach.
Oh, I'm disappointed. I thought you were
going to
tell me to
mix
up.
Yes.
Some water. Yeah, someone else did today.
This line of women I have to service. No.
Julie, if you're listening, he's kidding.
No, absolutely a joke. Your paint is like painting with pure light. Use his paint with your brushes. It's just like, well, I've died and gone to painter heaven. I mean that with all my heart.
Well, that means, I know what it means to me, and I'm sure it means the same to Rosemary's hair. That it's just, it's what we're here for.
But I can't use anybody else's stuff in it.
I know, I did warn you that it comes with a health warning. It is
addictive.
I know.
George is going to be addicted now?
I jokingly say it's a bit like the beginning of the Matrix film where the pill is offered and you're told that you take the pill, your life will never be the same again, you won't ever be, your reality will change forever, and that's true. Once you paint with it's a strange wake-up, and it's the same as Rosemary's brushes. I've seen people over the last few days, and you've got addicts, haven't you, Rosemary?
I actually sent you some, didn't I, for a while.
You did. Yeah, and you got me addicted as well.
Method in me madness.
Yeah, but no, we jokingly call ourselves the sort of the drug dealers. The first trick is free.
Yeah.
And then after that, you're hooked. So that's the health warning.
It's like that with art classes as well, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It is. But, you know, the whole experience of something like this here, what's happening right now, Michael will probably tell you the same. When you're self-employed in a small company, you bury yourself in your job for so many hours, and it can be a very lonely world. And my girls come in, they manufacture for me during the day, and then they all disappear. It's like 5 o'clock at tea time, and I'm like, gosh, that's just now the start of the night shift for me. And I spend so many hours on my own in my little business that, honestly, George, when I see an artist like you create something with something I made at 2 o'clock in the morning, that is like the lottery.
Wow.
That is winning the lottery. It is just so gratifying to stand and watch.
I actually had the pleasure to CCW Monday use Michael's paint. And I think he was using your brushes too, Rosemary.
Yeah.
And for the first time yesterday, and then I had the pleasure again to watch someone else have the same, epiphany, and it was just, it's amazing to watch these masters just go,
oh my God, you know, it was
interesting. The painting, of course, was absolutely beautiful. So
the only way I can describe it is like probably the first time someone experienced power steering in a car. It's like, really?
Yeah.
Power steering like this, as opposed to, like that. Yeah, it's just, I can't say enough good things about it.
Well, George, thank you. The checks in the post to you.
No, in fact, I first heard about the rosemary brushes from Richard Schmidt. I was talking to Richard Schmidt about the brushes, and I said, well, what brushes are you using? He goes, I'm using these rosemary brushes. This is going back quite a few years.
Yeah, he first,
because you have to try these brushes. And I'm like, oh, they're brushes.
Brushes.
And I'm thinking, how good can they be? And then when I first got them a couple of years ago, I was like,
so, George, I've got a quick question for you. The first time I saw you paint on the big, large one, we won't mention the name of paint, but they're thick, very, very thick. And,
yeah.
You know, and I'm not sure you got as thick with Michael's paint. Is it because it was a smaller painting?
It's because it's a smaller painting.
Okay. And that's what my curiosity was, because certainly the color of the vibrancy and all that was definitely there. I was wondering if it was because that, you know, you didn't have to use as much paint because the color vibrancy and the, you know, came through better, versus just that it was a smaller, it was a framework board of 18x24, I think.
Yeah, the other one was a 48x60, and that really was about texture, that whole painting. It was about brush.
The whole
painting was just about energy and
What brushes did you use today? Which of Rosemary's brushes? What type?
Oh, Rosemary's?
Yes.
I used, it's funny, for a guy that's been painting about 40-plus years, you know, I still say dumb things like, the real cool-looking square one, as opposed to, like, you know, a number 5 flat or a number 6 flat. I use the ivory, the synthetic ones. Are those the ones?
From the new range, the toxic, which is like 80% bristle,
20%.
Like
Oh, I love the riggers, yeah. I mean, the riggers changed everything for me, just the way I do the branches of it. It's like cuckoo with them, you know? Yeah. Anyway. So, yeah, but to answer your question, yeah, they were the flats and filberts, and I'd say, like, sizes, I'm guessing 4, 6, 8, somewhere around there.
Yeah, you were painting smaller today.
And sometimes I'll use something like, I'll use a 2-inch brush, you know, if I'm doing something really huge.
Uh-huh.
You know, just to lay in the dark, because I still tend to use smaller brushes because I'm trying to get, even in a dark passage, or I'm always trying to find the warms and the cools. If you do a large painting, I try to find, you know, like warms and cools of the same values inside of a passage, so that when you step back, it vibrates, you know, like from across the room on a huge canvas, as opposed to just painting a big matte kind of thing. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, so you're not using as large of brushes?
No, even on a large canvas sometimes. I might use a large brush to lay in to lay it in a little bit, but generally, I paint, you know, real alla prima. I mean, meaning, like, I don't, like, do a wash and then a thing and da-da-da-da. I mean, I really pretty much paint to finish from the very start, you know?
Yeah.
So now that I put everyone to sleep, is it?
Oh, God, yes.
That's how I think you get the energy and stuff. You know what I mean? It's not something I invented. The guy that
The guy that I think really made it work is a guy named Edward Redfield that we talked about yesterday. The Pennsylvania mm-hmm. Impressionist. I mean, he just put dabs next to dabs and grays next to these blue greens and then these sort of coppers. And, you know, you step away and it could be like a dark passage or something like in the woods in between the trees. And you swear you're seeing leaves out there and all kinds of stuff in shadow. And then you walk close and it's just chunks of stuff that he's just smacking it. It's just the greatest.
It's the art of suggestion, I think.
Yeah,
it is. And the mind somehow, our subconsciouses are serve these things up to us. And we, as you say, you could actually say, I'm sure that's for a leaf.
Yes.
Yeah, that we share those moments of reality. It's just that reality we all have.
It's the best thing because, you know, it's like the painting is making you dream in a way.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
as opposed to just it's answering every question.
That's magical. I think we all love to see it. That is art.
Well, I just
so
had
the
to
viewers...
come by and I just say hello to everybody. I
you need to go lie down.
I have to go lie down because I'm doing a roundtable discussion. I'm going to be doing it from a gurney if I don't want that. So goodbye, everybody. Nice to see
bye-bye,
you.
George.
Thanks for stopping by, George.
You got
I
it.
Appreciate it. And,
take care of yourself.
If you want to paint better, use Michael's paint and rosemary.
I love you, George.
Love you back.
And take that and we'll do
better. Hope you feel better. Okay, so there you have it. Rosemary's Brushes, Michael's Paint, Raymar Board,
so
three sponsors for Weekend with the Masters. Go to Juliet's Atelier and learn the basics, right? So
not for impressionist painting, but for
others. For
classic.
Yes.
And that's a bit, Linda's just showing me some of your work. People talking. It's again and again, it's a wow factor there. It's like you do, like George is just talking about a certain way that a few brushstrokes, and although you paint in a very literal way, a few brushstrokes, and the mind is in its full, it's almost like Trumpion, and I don't know if you agree with that, maybe I'm speaking out of place here, but the power, I saw certain deliberate brushstrokes, and it had that, oh wow, I wish I could do that. And it's such a, we've got the best jobs in the world, haven't we, guys?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, it's interesting because as the realist movement and the interest in representational arts has started coming back, you tend to find these sort of divisions like you would in a, you know, church, early church. You know, we do infant baptisms. We don't, you know, we're like all these different
like religious factions. And we're willing to fight over it as well.
Well, we are, and we don't like your work because you put reflective light in and we're up the camp where, you know, all the shadows should be flat. You're turning forms, or you put too much information in, and so I can't appreciate your art because it's finished versus being suggestive. And the breadth of human experience is greatly varied.
Mm-hmm.
And there's times I love, you know, who doesn't love Bach? Everybody loves Bach, if you have any sense at all. But there's times when you want to crank up really loud music because you want to feel something very powerful.
Yes.
And it's not intellectual. It's just a visceral response. And so there's, you know, every single person will have a different response to what they're looking at, and there'll be a time when that is just perfectly needed. And so I agree, the Pennsylvania Impressionists, I look at it and I think of home. I grew up around that area and I look at it and think, I love this work. However, I've watched an artist's work recently where he spent 2 weeks so carefully developing something, start a portrait drawing. Wow, what depth of love to put that much time in. Where you're not necessarily suggesting it, but you want to know this person. Every wrinkle and every, it's a form of love. And, you know, if you go into a crowd and you're invisible, You can tell because nobody looks at you. There's no eye contact being made. You look and you see one person who sees you. And it's almost the beginning of friendship. And for an artist like that, yes, you can say, well, they summed it, you know, they're painting, you know, little hair, this and that. But it's just a different form of expression. When they look at you, it's like the John Berger thing. It's like very few, you know, painters paint like Degas, where it's like a mother looking at a child, bust naked, seeing everything about them. And we had the conversation, too, about when I was in New York City, I had and Juliet studied at Jacob Collins' school. I can't remember the name.
I was in a studio over in Colina's place.
You were
Brooklyn.
Okay, it was before that.
And then Water Street later.
Yeah, Water Street. But I had the opportunity, Jacob actually gave us a tour, and I walked through, you know, and I was telling Juliet, you know, here's somebody that was actually sculpting out the bones of the foot, you know, and then there was somebody else that was putting the muscle structure on the foot, and, you know, all these different degrees, and then they were drawing the foot for weeks, and the hands, and the different body, you know, part torso, everything. Then there was a model sitting, and everybody was painting, you know, this. So there was this learning that went through this whole thing. And I walked out of there like totally, I was telling her, I walked out of there totally depressed because it was like, oh, my God, I'm never going to get there. You know, I'm never going to be, but that's not the type of artist I am. You know,
right, but also.
But I have a love for that. I mean.
Also think of it not as something that shows that you're either that kind of artist or not. You know, when you're in this business, okay. So physically, have you ever sat at the table with people who had no, they were interested in you, but they could hear the
smoke?
No,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so in contrast, you're sitting with someone, and they draw you out, okay, they pull you out. There's certain types of artists who always want to know. And they're the people who always at the start of the conversation will always be experimenting, because what they have to say about it is less important than what they have to learn. So if you think that snapshot that you saw, not so much of a fixed state of an artist who just happens to be obsessive, although maybe they gravitate towards it, but looking for a pretty where they can learn, maybe indefinitely.
But, you know, absolutely. In your book, the book that you were so kind to send me, you know, I've been looking through them, and we talked about them on the last show, and it was really interesting, too, because so much of looking at your book is training my eye in a different way. So when I look at a particular painting, I start to see things that perhaps are just a little off that I didn't see before, that somebody didn't have that same experience of looking through your books and seeing that form or seeing how that area, you know, turns and things. So it became very much an education to me. You know, maybe I never want to actually paint that particular way, but that certainly has helped my eye to start seeing things in a different way.
Yeah, and that also moves us back out, because all of us are the seekers after something to provide their lost language, the materials that just quite work correctly. And one thing that it seems like, at least I'm missing living in Seattle, it seems that between all the things we have going on, there's a lot of fragmentation. And what we miss in a certain way is this continuity with something bigger and deeper, a language that doesn't just start with us, but starts with, you know, whatever, you've got your realm.
This is the human song, I call it. It's this sort of thing that we all have. Right. Some of that thought frame, do you think? No, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, contextual information. So you're studying a little bit, and all of a sudden you catch that glimpse. You see through someone else's eyes. You're able to make a small correction in your work. It's not just you anymore. It's you and somebody else.
Can I ask a question to you? Yeah. I mean, as you're talking, which is, you know, it's great to hear you talk. Look at your work, and it's like, she's got it. She's got it all. And those of you who don't know, Julia's a young lady. And I look at the work and I think, oh, what have you got left to learn? When I look at the work, I mean, I know, of course, you're going to have treat the question in whatever way you like, but you've got all the answers when I look at your work. What have you got left that you want to go
this lady's a busy woman.
I know, I'm sure, but your work is so accomplished. It's like you've cheat talked.
Super kind of you, and I never feel that. I always feel a little bit broken and off, just like most artists. You could have a new look at this. If only I can, you know, nail it. This is going to be the painting where my thoughts started. The thing I'm trying to paint is all going to come together, and people are going to look at it, and they're going to absolutely get it. And you finish the painting.
Yeah, I know. Well, I knew you were going to answer like that. I just wanted to hear you say it. Because it's just, well, working.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You have a word. Thank you. No, never. But on the years later, sometimes I do. At the time, there's always a cycle with the paintings, and it just seems weird. Isn't it remarkable how someone is so cute that they can experience things like every time they do a drawing or they get lost in the joy of it, and then you have this moment of just free, you know, free fall. Oh my gosh, it's not right now. And at the end, then you draw on your storehouse of knowledge. Well, I check my edges. Is the proportion okay? Has the composition, is there screwed up in the composition?
Yeah, that's, I also find it very interesting because there's so often the case where if the work doesn't go according to plan, it's simply just not going according to plan, that the magic didn't come together. Or there could be something fundamentally very significant and interesting about that. But, you know, what's thrown the wild card in here? And, I mean, I'm terrible because I'm very ruthless with my work. In fact, I destroyed everything I ever did at one time. Yeah, I burnt a lot. And often you hear from artists, but anyway, which was a silly move at the time.
I burnt my book.
But then, let me think. I burnt all my student work and all my youth work before being student and everything up to... When I did this, I was probably about 40. And... whatever the psychological reasons that are prompting me to do that, you know, it's complete acts of stupidity. And in a way, I was a 40-year-old man beating up a 13-year-old boy who'd done the paintings. And, I mean, it's just silly beyond belief. And whatever the self-identity thing I was, oh, I don't know what I was trying to achieve, but I'm rambling on this one. But with the significant works, sometimes you can't recognize the time, and you don't know whether to throw them in the bin, hide them, or stow them away just in case in 2 years' time you step back and you think, ah, that was going somewhere, and it's somewhere that I've never been before.
Exactly. So I'm going
to tell you a funny joke,
okay? Well, I thought it was hysterical. I was visiting my brother to get a copy of his New Yorker, which was last month, and there was this read me so deeply, so I thought I was the only one. There's a picture of a mother, you know, sort of tucking her little boy into bed. And she said, I don't know, this is not verbatim, don't be afraid of the dark, honey, because the dark isn't very scary. Be afraid of your past, because when you're older, lying awake at night, it's going to gnaw your very soul. And it's not, oh, my God.
That's the sort of the day, folks. Yeah.
You're happy.
And Julie's the mother. She's got six kids. She
knows what she's talking about.
Yeah. She actually is a mother. I don't know about the six kids part, but
thank you.
Yeah.
It's great. This is the doom and gloom. We had a doom and gloom statement yesterday, and we have a doom and gloom statement today.
As a caveat, just to temper that, that's where all our clean thoughts come from, and that's what keeps us humble and hungry and excited. I mean, if you don't have an emotional range, if you're never upset, if you're never down, you're never up at night wondering where you went wrong, you're never going to think that easy about anything or experience the high. So it's not that bad.
Do you dream of that? In your dreams, are you problem solving within a painting?
No.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to come make an order. You're going to wake up next morning. Oh, no, I'm
going to stop. I dream that my equipment that I make the paint with is that I get to work and it's all become small. It should be. And I hope there's not the shrinks are going to call in and tell me what's wrong with me on that one, but I get quite a lot of reoccurring dreams. Now, other one is I can't remember where I parked my car.
No, that's
is it? Yeah, or I can't make my mobile phone
work.
Or
which sort of car it is.
Yeah, or what my name is. No, I'm joking.
But that's, I have that too. That's part of being an artist, is being completely disoriented almost all the rest of the time.
Trying to make chaos of it all that we find ourselves in. Or rather, not make chaos of it, not the wrong way around, make order of the chaos we find ourselves in.
Can I ask you a question? Yeah. And this really isn't arty art related. As a businesswoman, I like to think I am, most of my life, my weekly life, is spent on business, on commerce, on working out profit margins. It might all be the same. You have to love for your job, but you also have to make a living from it. My question is, how on earth, when we see a creation of yours, how do you actually put a price on it? How do you work the cost of what the final painting is going to cost? In this conversation before, you said this guy spent a couple of weeks just doing so much of saying, oh, my, 2 weeks. That's
and the model fees are long
for 2 weeks on just realistic. So sorry to say this to everybody, but yeah, 2 weeks is just about like this part time. There's no way you can create a piece.
Yeah.
It just isn't possible. But for that, we have other quotes that we draw on our resources, our source material, like Tolstoy, who said that a real work of art is never sold. Okay, I'm not making a living. It's because of my integrity. But ideally, an artist would be compensated for what they do. Very difficult to put any kind of real price on that amount of time. And also, it's hard to get... I remember trying to put a price on something early in my career, and it took me 6 months to do a single painting. I had studio fees of $600 a month. My time, and yet there's not a person in the world that would buy it. Well, would it be worth that amount of money?
It would, but you're right, taxation, everything.
And then over time, it gets much quicker. And so it's funny, it's hard to assess these things because you all charge the thing for drawing the thing to you.
This is actually very hard for artists to figure out what price point.
Some people are really good at it, and I'm not. That would be a good person to get on your show.
I've often thought that it might be rather interesting from a sort of financial point of view to, rather than selling works, you lease them out so that someone might buy the... you buy the rights for, say, 3 years, so you can hang it in your home, and then after 3 years, it reverts back to the artist. It's like a lease. And, you know, you could have a 999-year lease, or however you like to look at it. So that sort of elements of things like copyright and sorts of things could be protected and controlled. I mean, this is something that the lawyers would probably have a lot of fun with, but... No, you know, attributing value to art is an extraordinary thing to have to do, and hearing you there talking, and I'm thinking, yeah, he's right. You know, it's sort of, it has to be, because people, you want to create the best thing you can, and the public want the best thing of you they can.
But, you know, it's interesting, how many people, when you walk into their home, have this collection of original art?
Mm-hmm.
I find that a depressingly small number. So your idea of, you know, getting people interested in collecting.
And stuff that some of them have got on the wall shouldn't be allowed anyway.
Some of them, they just don't get it, do they?
No.
Not just my friends don't get it.
But again, this is a debate of what art is. And be it some kitsch painting that like some clown group's makeup on or whatever like that is. But,
Came over from England.
The ancient school of kitten painting. I can never find my kitten.
Yeah. Back home we have the store IKEA. And I'll go into IKEA to buy boxes, really boring boxes, but they're really cheap. And whilst I'm walking around IKEA, what I would class young newlyweds.
Yeah.
Fill in the trolley.
And they're in the picture section.
And I cannot believe it. They are spending £200 sterling on a print. Yeah, they don't realise that if you buy original work.
Exactly, my
friends
are selling great.
And they get the checkout, and they're like 600-700 pounds on the back of
vision. you also spend a lot of time in colleges and when you see student work, and yeah, I totally agree, and I think it's something that would be lovely to get a website, but particularly designed for something promoting this type of work for students, so it helps fund their way through their studies, whereby, you know, you could do 60, 40-inch painting, and you could pick up the peanut, and that art student's going to be, you know, a couple hundred bucks, whatever, better off, and that gets food probably for a couple of weeks.
Well, you had a really good idea, Julia, and it worked. When I remarried 5 years ago, the most gorgeous one on the planet,
too late, baby.
You know, we have the wedding list. Well, what the heck do I want at my age? Second marriage. Don't need, you know, I don't need another kettle of toaster. So it's a joke.
You don't need paintbrushes. That's
no, a joke. I actually said on my website, in my newsletter to my customers, which they only get one a year, not that regular. And there's sort of a joke, tongue-in-cheek. I said, yeah, you know, one or two have asked me what would I like on my wedding list. So I said, I am doing one. And there's only one thing I want, and it's an original piece of art. I got 27.
Oh my goodness.
No, oh, really? So when you say you walk into somebody's home, my home is like a gallery now.
Wonderful.
But it was just such a quirky thing to ask for. And I got everything from like your tiny little, the lady down the street who can't really paint, never will be able to, but she's painted her cat for many. And I thought, right the way up to some of the UK's top artists who like just thrown it in a tube and sent it to me and said, here, frame it yourself.
Oh, wow.
So I got 27 pieces of art.
Later, you need to go back to do the 60
years. No, darling, you could remarry.
I'll make a starter marriage.
Just kidding. Okay. So, I know we kind of sit around the table here and talk, and Blanche is in North Carolina, and Blanche, I don't know how much you're actually getting to hear, but do you want to ask Juliet or Rosemary or Michael a question?
Oh, yeah, I am having a hard time hearing you guys tonight. Let's see, Juliet. Well, we talked about the critiques on Sunday. What's going on tomorrow at the symposium?
Yeah, tonight we're doing roundtable discussion with participants, and tomorrow I'm going to be spending a lot of time at the school, and then Sunday the critiques, but also tomorrow will be my chance finally to sit in and learn from the other artists, so I plan on dropping in as many as I can. There's still workshops going on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's great stuff to be heard everywhere around there, all those wonderful artists.
Yeah, I think George has a workshop tomorrow. I think Kwang Ho has one tomorrow. Carol Anderson, I believe, has another one tomorrow. David LaFell. I know CW is done after the roundtables tonight. I think there's another discussion, a couple different discussion things going on in the morning tomorrow as well. So they still have some of the artists still have a full day of stuff going on. Some of them, like Juliet, who gets a day off now because she did her first 2.5 or 3 days, I guess, up front.
Yeah.
And there's also some plein air things going on as well. When they go plein air, they take a bus out of here at 7:30 in the morning, and they don't get back until about 5 or 5:30, somewhere in there. So they're out all day, and you see them kind of dragging in.
I think it's hot out there, isn't it? It's hot, isn't it? I was seeing today it was like 103 in San Francisco, and y'all are way south of there.
Wow. We've been working hard. We haven't seen the light of day. It's tough where we are.
Called air conditioning. Juliet did mention the round table, and there are folks that are coming back from painting out that the sponsors need to get back and help with and all this. So as a result of that, we're going to wrap up really quickly so that folks can get refreshed for the round table discussion and the sponsors can get back and start to talk with some of the participants some more as well. So thank you so much, Juliet, for stopping by. I really appreciate it. And And thank you, Rosemary, for coming by. I hope we didn't scare you off too badly. And naturally, Michael, thank you for coming by all 3 days. Yeah, it's been fun to do this. We'll do some promotion stuff on this. We'll write a little summary and things like that. I'll put links to everybody's websites that are out there, and we'll get some stuff out in a newsletter and all that too.
I'm
but
Michael,
I can write that. Yeah.
So it's good. I don't know. Michael and I have been talking about doing some stuff on where we talked about making people learn about the paints more, so understand them.
I never want to presume to place myself in the position of teacher. He knows everything. I certainly do not. I'm learning every day. But no, I just love the fun of the subject and prompting other people's artistic experience. I just love being part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yes, we've got some great shows as well. Is coming up as well. Jerry McGraw will be on our show on September 20th, and Michael Pierce will be on our show on September 25th. And then I'm trying to work on Kevin McPherson and CW to do a show with us in October. I've got Kevin.
That'll
okay
be a lot
on
of fun.
Okay, yep, and I've gotten CW's on that, and then I've also got sometime in the future CW and George together, which we're just going to sit back on that one and let those two talk because we'll never get a word in edgewise.
We wouldn't be able to talk, would we?
No, not between those two. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and we will be back on the air on September 20th at 7 p.m. Eastern. And thanks again for everybody that tuned in yesterday. We have one of our largest listening audiences in the last 24 hours that we've ever had on this show. So if you're listening tonight, thank you all out there in Radio Land, Blog Talk Radio Land, because you know without your support, we wouldn't be able to do this. So thank you so much for tuning in.
Thank you. Good night.